threatened as we've been led to believe.
The story that art tells us is that this was never an age of darkness. This was an age of light.
Valdemar Januszczak illuminates the treasures of a neglected era.
This famous Christian sign, the Christogram, represents Jesus himself.
We still call Christmas Xmas because of this.
The Dark Ages, an age of light. This Tuesday night at 9 on BBC 4.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Thomas Keneally is one of Australia's most distinguished and popular writers. He's written more than 30 novels, dramas, screenplays, and books of non-fiction. In Australia, he's twice received the Miles Franklin Award. He was shortlisted for the Booker three times before winning for Schindler's Ark, which of course was later made into a classic film. His novel, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, is regarded as an Australian classic. Now, Tom, when I met you in Australia, going to a concert in that wonderful opera house, I realised that amongst your passions was not only rugby union and league, but also music.
Well, that's true. I have a very primitive interest in music because I was never trained as a musician. But when I was a child, there was a particular teacher who took aside a number of kids so inclined and introduced us to Beethoven and then to Mahler. There were Sunday afternoon concerts in the Sydney Town Hall, free orchestral concerts, and we used to attend those every Sunday afternoon. And my passion for classical music and folk music in particular, I think it was accentuated by studying for a time for the priesthood, which in a sociological sense was a great mistake. But in terms of music, in those days, church music was not written by tone-deaf Jesuits, but was written by real composers, and the context of music within the Mass or music within a church service is obvious from what we're going to hear today. But you are talking to a primitive, Michael, when it comes to music.
But the Mozart Requiem that you've chosen is something which I think you feel you could have the whole thing at your funeral very happily.
Yes, indeed. None of that modern church music for guitar plunkers and, as I said, tone-deaf Jesuits. This is simply part of Mozart's great Requiem, and it is miraculous in all its components. And again, it shows that the Mass provided a context for a lot of great writing.
Thank you.
that weeping figure on the strings with which the movement opens almost looks forward to the Romantic era, doesn't it?
I didn't think of it in those terms until you just mentioned it, but it does look forward to it. In fact, I think the simplicity of some of the Requiem, when his other work can be quite ornate, the Magic Flute and so on, the purity of the line interests me. I mean, it is written by a man who is under an extraordinary force of something. And the Ave Verum he wrote is just purely melodic. It doesn't pull any tricks. Yes, that's what's interesting about the Requiem. It's not as full of tricks as a lot of his other stuff.
Straight from the heart.
Mm.
The Lacrimosa from the Requiem in D minor, Kirkel 626 by Mozart. We heard the John Aldiss Choir and the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Thomas Keneally, I've been reading with enormous pleasure your latest book, The Daughters of Mars, which is about two girls, Methodist background, I guess, who find themselves obviously keen for adventure and getting away from the sort of homestead they've been used to, but finding themselves as a result as nurses at the Dardanelles conflict in about 1915. And the writing is incredibly graphic. I find the descriptions of, for example, the wounds, just to take one point, absolutely wonderful. But even in getting there, there are some very poetic lines. If I could just read you four lines of your own book where you describe these girls as they made their way to this conflict on board a boat and as they were about to cross the equator. And you write, "Yet now here was the equator, the burning and unconsumed filament that divided the world of southern innocence from the world of northern gravity of intent, and the hemisphere of colonists from the hemisphere of the owners." Well, I think it's a wonderful description of North versus South.
Yes, I'm almost impressed by that myself. Yes. The interesting thing that I wanted to explore about people from the New World is that we are always astonished by the intimacy of Europe and the glory of Europe combined with its great savageries. There is a character in the book, Charlie Condon, a young man who's very impressed by the Impressionists. And he says, if only we could put the Impressionists and Australia together. We've got the light, they've got the talent. And he's amazed that such a short distance from the Louvre Gallery in Paris, there is the body part impregnated trenches, the gas impregnated mud, and the continuous life of savagery beyond the imagination of people pre-1914. And I am amazed by the Balkans. That I know the historic reasons why the Balkans are the way they are now and have been. But there are countries as large as municipalities in Australia with grievous histories, and you know where the grievances come from. But again, there in particular, you get writ large, if I might be contradictory in what I say, writ large, the intimacy of European passion and European savagery. So these are the two things that your cousin Hicks from a far place have never been able to work out about Europe. And so again, the young women from a small country town are astonished to see Rouen Cathedral, and then they go back to the base hospital and they nurse men to whom the greatest obscenities have occurred.
Perhaps it would be interesting to hear some music and your reactions to it, which is actually quintessentially English.
Yes, well, I love Elgar, And when I was young, we lived in England for about 18 months. And at Covent Garden, there was a ballet of the Enigma Variations, a brilliant ballet, and we must have seen it four or five times. I loved the music so much.
Ashton, I think.
Yes, that's right. And Elgar, I would like to nominate as part of my tribute to my friends in England, Elgar's violin concerto.
Thank you.
The second movement, part of it, from the Violin Concerto in B minor, opus 61, by Elgar. We heard Thomas Zettmar, the soloist, with the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Sir Mark Elder. There's an overwhelming sense of yearning and melancholy there, isn't there?
Yes.
Do you relate to that, Thomas Keneally?
I do. Both the melancholy, people think I'm a very egregious character, but I have a Mississippi of melancholy running through beneath that apparently gregarious nature. Yes, I like yearning, aspiring, holding on to life by the fingertips sort of music.
But I think if we were to come to a composer who perhaps for you transcends many of the others, everything is more contained in a Baroque way, isn't it? And yet it still has the same emotional power.
You're speaking of Bach. Yes, I love the Bach cantatas. Some of them, I have to confess, seem purely functional and connective to me. But the ones...
I guess if you're writing one for virtually every day of the religious calendar,
that's right.
You could be forgiven the odd
yes,
de rigueur.
Right. That's right. And I like people who are reckless enough to write too much because I do it myself. But, of course, there are many that are transcendent, and this by Bach is transcendent. And my Antipodean perversion is that most of the composers I like wrote before Australia was even settled by Europeans.
Thank you.
quite interesting the way Bach has the melody very much in the orchestra. And the singer is almost like a recitative round it sometimes.
Yes, that's true. Next time I'm walking through the bush listening to my iPod, I'll remember that. It's something I hadn't thought about.
Zion hört die Wächter singen from Cantata number 140, BWV 140. The tenor was Kurt Equilutz with the Concertus Musicus Wien, directed by Nikolaus Arnoncourt. Well, this brings us very nicely to the film that was made of Schindler's Ark, of course, called Schindler's List. It must be rather wonderful to have a book that becomes such a successful film. Did you actually like the film yourself?
I did. Inevitably, there were aspects which were a little naive, if I dare say so, but film is a naive form in many ways. It has to take one line through all the subplots and texture of the book. And novelists who want the film to be a sort of illustrated comic of their novel are doomed to disappointment. I think what a writer is lucky with is should a director happen to treat his her novel with integrity. And I think that Spielberg did that, to be honest. And I think I've been very fortunate in the few films that have been made of my work, that integrity of approach has been there. I particularly liked the music. Music tends to be forgotten as one watches a film, and it sometimes takes two or three viewings to realize how good some film music is. There is some great film music, and I think there's none greater than what Itzhak Perlman, John Williams, wrote for Schindler. I mean, we have a wonderful talent generally producing far more commercially sounding material. Coming, in the case of John Williams, to meet a magnificent violinist in Itzhak Perlman.
Thank you.
I thought of two things as we were listening to that, Tom Keneally. One was that actually, unlike a lot of film music, that does have organic development. So it kind of bears listening to, even, well, it would anyway, because it's quite an arresting theme. But the other was how a theme like that, married to what was going on in the film, was almost unbearable.
Yes, it is so well married that it slipped past me. But Williams drew on a lot of Yiddish music and Eastern European music as the basis. And there is a lot of it that develops in that way that simply doesn't repeat the chief attractive tune.
And of course, for those people who don't know the film or the book, it is all about the Holocaust, I should say. That was the theme from Schindler's List, music by John Williams, and it's from the original soundtrack recording conducted by the composer with Itzhak Perlman, as you said, Tom Keneally, playing the violin. Well, now we come to your Handel, the precocious Handel, with whom you identify.
Yes, a man who wrote too much again. Look, I was converted to Handel. I knew of him, I'd heard something of his work. But there was a wonderful Italian film called Farinelli Il Castrato.
Oh, yes, about the castrato, yes.
And he knew Handel and sang for Handel. And there's a lot of Handel's music in Farinelli. And in it, I heard this particular aria from Rinaldo. But as well as that, the Australian Opera put on this year a Handel opera called Partenope, which I don't like as much as Rinaldo. And they're embarrassed by some of the melodrama of both the action and the florid nature of the music. And so they presented it as a farcical opera. I felt they didn't do Handel the tribute he deserves for Let the Bright Seraphim, for the oratorio, for another aria from this opera, Cara Sposa. So this is my apology passed on from the Australian Opera to Handel for an aria of great purity and again of yearning.
Lascia ch'io pianga mia crude sorte, from Act 2, Scene 4 of Rinaldo by Handel. Cecilia Bartoli with the Academy of Ancient Music, directed by Christopher Hogwood.
And where would we punters be without Christopher Hogwood?
True. So, from Handel we turn to a fellow countryman of yours, and it combines Australia and your Irish roots, which is nice. And I have to say that I do think Percy Grainger would have been very intrigued by the castrati, don't you?
Percy Grainger was an extraordinarily colourful human being. He was a virtuoso who, when touring remote Australia or remote South Africa or remote Canada or the Western US, would walk from one recital to another. If it was a mere 25 miles, he'd set off. He very attached to his mother, which is not a bad thing, but he was perhaps too attached to his mother and had a taste for flagellation. His mother very graphically committed suicide from the window of Percy's music publisher in New York. But instead of treating him as an item of gossip, as I am, he was a very important collector of the folk music of the British Isles, and of course English Country Garden, and there are stories of his lying under a double bed to hear someone's shy granny sing a near-forgotten British folk song. This isn't the greatest melody anyone has heard, but the world would be poorer without it, and we owe its continuation to Percy Grainger.
Colleen Duss by Percy Grainger, the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Geoffrey Simon. We're going to have something rather more bouncy now to offset that lyrical mood, aren't we,
Tom? Yes, I have a lot of Yo-Yo Ma and his cello on my iPod, to which I listen for possibly a couple of hours a day. And since it would now be good to have something jolly and uplifting, this composer, Italian Filippo Azzolo, will provide us with a Philip.
Thank you.
Well, actually, Tom, I think that music was the earliest we've had in the programme because the composer, Filippo Azzaiolo, was mid-16th century Italian.
Yes.
And we heard Yo-Yo Ma with members of the Silk Road Ensemble performing Chi passa per sta strada. We've only glanced upon one of your great passions, and that is rugby. Both league and union, I think.
Yes, that northern game, which I believe is in some financial trouble now, rugby league. I grew up playing it and have been involved for many years in a club in Sydney. And I've coached rugby itself, respectable rugby. Yes, it's a variation in my life. I don't see as much now as I used to. I've resigned from one of my more notable positions in rugby league to give time to grandchildren because grandchildren are immensely more therapeutic than any sport and also immensely more demanding.
But well, since we've come on to family matters, as a very dutiful husband, I think you're going to pay tribute now not only to your wife, but also to a wonderful singer of the Southern Hemisphere.
Yes, this song from the Averne, actually performed by the great New Zealander, Kiri Teikanua, but my wife's little group of coffee drinkers, women of a certain age, let's say, had a discussion and decided that this was their favourite song, and it has, from the lips of Kiri Teikanua, of mixed Polynesian and Anglo-New Zealand descent, it has a wonderful purity, as you'll hear.
Thank you.
Cantaloube's Bailero from Songs of the Auvergne, Kirite Kanawa with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Geoffrey Tait. Now, finally, Tom Keneally, if I were to say to you that I think Epictetus the Stoic would be very pleased with you, can you explain to our audience why that would be?
Well, I don't think I can quote Epictetus accurately, but he said something along these lines. Instead of wishing the world were as you would desire it to be, accept it as it is, and all will go well with your life. Now, I have wasted a lot of time trying to achieve an end or hoping that someone will come round to my point of view. It's bad karma to do so and accept the world as it is. Not all will go well with your life. There's still taxes and cancer and politics, but in terms of personal serenity, it's a proposition I try to live by. And I think the Stoics have got a bad press, but in fact, in Stoicism is a fountain of joy, which has been cemented over by the meaning we have come to attach to the word Stoic.
That was a tiny part of you, Tom Keneally, that's returning to the priesthood. Many thanks.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful to listen to that music with you.
Thomas Keneally was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the former Prime Minister, Sir John Major. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
An unmissable Thursday afternoon on BBC Radio 3. Puccini's one-act opera Il Tabarro, The Cloak. An international cast, Daniel Harding and the Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra in a performance given earlier in the week in Stockholm. And Dvorak and Sibelius performed live in Belfast by the Ulster Orchestra. Afternoon on 3, Thursday from 2 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Well, at 2 o'clock this afternoon, we've a recent concert from the BBC Philharmonic. Gian Andrea Nozeda is conducting, and Jean Eflam Barbouzet is playing not one, but two Prokofiev piano concertos. There's also the Third Symphony of Alfredo Casella and a Verdi overture to begin the concert. That's in an hour from now at 2 o'clock. Before that, we're off on a tour of Europe with Dr. Charles Burney in today's early music show in a couple of minutes. But now at just after 1 o'clock, this is John Shea in London with the latest BBC news. David Cameron has promised that the government will make sure everything possible is done to assist people affected by floods and storms in southern and central England. Devon and Cornwall police say 250 homes have been flooded in the counties. A woman died during a storm in Exeter when a tree fell on her tent. Floodwaters swept through 40 houses in Kempsey in Worcestershire despite new defences. A man has died after his car went into a swollen river in Cambridgeshire. The emergency services say a passerby pulled the 70-year-old man out of the water near the village of Erith, but he could not be revived. There's been a powerful bomb attack near a Shia Muslim procession in northwest Pakistan for the second day in a row. Five people died and at least 80 were wounded in the explosion in the city of Dera Ismail Khan. A new law making stalking a specific criminal offence has come into force in England and Wales. Offenders will now face up to 6 months in jail for stalking, or up to 5 years for stalking that creates fear of violence. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has insisted that the government will not decide what action to take over media regulation until it's read the findings of Lord Justice Leveson's inquiry into press ethics, which is to be published on Thursday. But Mr. Hague said he believed in erring on the side of freedom. Andy Robinson has stepped down as the head coach of the Scotland Rugby Union team. The team has suffered a string of poor results, culminating in yesterday's 21-15 defeat by Tonga in Aberdeen. cricket, and it's been a very good day for England in the second test match against India in Mumbai. The tourists took a first innings lead of 86 after being bowled out for 413. They then reduced India to 117 for 7 by the close of play. Monty Panesar took 5 wickets, meaning he's taken 10 wickets so far in the match. And the weather. Winds will ease as rain in the north and east gradually clears. Further heavy rain will spread across Wales and southwest England during the afternoon. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 3 minutes past one. So now it's time for today's early music show with Lucy Skeeping.
Things that really helps us to enjoy early music, I think, is to understand its context. And those of you who listen regularly to the programme might have noticed that we quite often quote from the 18th century musician and writer Charles Burney. He was a great traveller, and his descriptions of the composers he met, the music he heard, and of course where it was performed, are a really valuable source to us today. Much like Samuel Pepys's diary 100 years earlier, Burney's writings are full of colourful personal observations. But unlike Pepys, Burney eventually published his experiences in two sort of travel books. And I'm delighted to welcome back to the Early Music Show today the musician and publisher Ian Gammy, who's going to talk us through one of Burney's journeys. His second European tour, in fact, which began in the summer of 1772. This time, Burney's destination was the Netherlands and the German-speaking lands. And he seems to have been very much taken, wasn't he, Ian, with the sound of the carillon. That was the instrument we've just been listening to, which was so prevalent in the Low Countries.
That's right. The carillon was not something he'd heard before, because, of course, English church bells just had a simple chime. But the carillon was operated not with ropes like the English church bells, but with a set of wooden pegs, if you like, or wooden rods, which you had to bash with your hands really fiercely to make the bells chime. And he was astonished at the physical effort involved. He wrote, "The carillons or chimes played a great number of cheerful tunes, which awakened my curiosity so much, I mounted the town belfry and was astonished at the great quantity of bells I saw. The carillonneur was literally at work. He was in his shirt with the collar unbuttoned and in a violent sweat. He said he was forced to go to bed the instant it was over to prevent his catching cold, so much exhausted as to be unable to speak."
Very different from England, obviously, at that time.
Yes, really hard work.
Burney had already been on quite a few trips before he came to the Netherlands. I mean, he'd been to France and Italy,
yes,
hadn't he? I mean, was he sort of expecting to find something very new and very different as far as music was concerned?
He had an open mind, but obviously he was expecting to find similarities, perhaps in the opera, there'd be French and Italian influences. But in Germany, he was particularly taken with some of the very good instrumentalists, and also he praised German instrument makers.
So how did he start? Where did he go first?
Well, he went through the Low Countries. We've already mentioned the carillon that he heard. And, of course, he went to churches and saw libraries and so on to research the early manuscripts he was after. But his first big port of call was really Mannheim, as he travelled down the Rhine, because at Mannheim, the great Johann Stamitz had set up an orchestra that was famous throughout Europe. And when he got there, he was especially impressed by the good orchestral discipline of the Elector-Palatine's orchestra. All the bowing and phrasing was very well planned and organised, and particularly the crescendi and diminuendi. And he said, "One of the principal dancers here is the daughter of the late celebrated Stamitz, from whose fire and genius the present style of symphonies was derived, so full of great effects of light and shade. It was here that the crescendo and diminuendo had birth, and the piano and the forte were found to be musical colours which had many shades."